Kate Road in Kingsley Napoli, and today I have a panel of colleagues and one very welcome external guest to discuss the issue of unconscious bias. I will invite the participants to say a few words about themselves, and then hopefully we will move on to an exciting and interesting exchange of ideas. And I'm hoping that by the end some themes will emerge so that we can work out how we move forward the agenda. So to start with our external guest, Catherine Rowe. Over to you, Catherine. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Kate, and the rest of the participants. I very much appreciate you inviting me to join you in this discussion, which I'm very excited to be able to discuss and share ideas about how best we move forward in a workplace. Just a background, a little bit about myself. I'm currently a chief financial officer of a publicly listed oil and gas business. I've spent most of my career in the city and investment banking before I moved into an industry role nearly 5 years ago, and now taking on an executive management role and a board director. So I have spent the majority of my career in a male-dominated environment, and there has proved some challenges but also some opportunities, which I think will be interesting for us to discuss today.
That sounds absolutely amazing, and yes, as you say, very, very male-dominated role, which leads me nicely to the male perspective. Over to you, Ed Smythe.
Thank you. I'm Ed Smythe. I'm a senior associate in the criminal litigation department here at Kingsley Napoli. I'm interested to take part in this podcast, really to explore the way in which we can identify and recognise our unconscious biases, because I'm sure that we all have them across a range of issues, and then perhaps to think about how we can challenge those, and maybe challenge is in some ways the wrong word because that sort of implies an element of confrontation, and I think perhaps it's resolving them, recognizing them, and working out how to overcome them in a way which can be done in a spirit of collaboration.
Okay, thanks, Ed. And finally, over to you, Shanette.
Hi, thanks so much, Kate. I'm Shanette Thompson. I'm a lawyer here at Kingsley Napoli in the regulatory team. So I generally assist regulated professionals mainly in the healthcare sector, but also other sectors such as education. My input into the podcast today, much like Catherine, I'm really interested in discussing this topic. I was brought up in Hackney in the 80s, so well before the regeneration that it's seen in the last 10 years. I come from a family where both parents were born outside of England, born in the West Indies, and immigrated here. So a lot of the experience that I've had in the legal profession has been people approaching me with preconceived views about the type of upbringing I've had, the focus on education, and also how I may have proceeded in my legal career up until this point. So this is a very interesting topic for me to discuss.
And Chan, you've talked to me previously about your experience in firms you've worked in the past, and would you feel able to share those with us now?
Yeah, absolutely. My experiences at Kingsley Napoli have been really positive. I've been here since 2011, so quite clearly I'm a happy person working here. But not just at firms that I've worked at previously, but just generally in the profession previously, even at university, kind of studying law. I've had experiences which have really made me realise that we all have, as Ed says, we've all got unconscious biases, and we have to recognise those so that we can tackle them. But one of the things I think that is generally mistaken about me is because my parents were born outside of the UK and I come from a working class background, that somehow that it's a poor background, which it absolutely isn't. The key focus in my home was on education, was on advancement. My parents are absolute go-getters, and they were really, really supportive of both me and my sister in our educational pursuits. So one thing that I did not feel at any time in my upbringing was poor. The other issue I think that I have been subject to is being a female from a West Indian background, that people automatically think that your parents, and not that there's anything wrong with these professions, that they automatically assume that I would be a secretary or a nurse or one of the professions that people generally associate with women. And again, I say I have no issues whatsoever with anybody that does those professions. They are good professions to be in, but it's just that automatic assumption that that's what I was going to do, that I found quite uncomfortable at various points when discussing my pursuits with people. On one occasion, and I know I've spoken to you about this before, Kate, I got into a taxi with someone that I live nearby. We don't know each other very well, but we were both going the same way. And we just had a quick chat, and she said to me, oh, where do you work? And I said, Kingsley Napoli. And her immediate response to me was to say, oh, are you a PA? She didn't ask me what I do. She immediately assumed that I am a PA. And it was interesting because for me, it took me aback almost, because she was a black woman. So I was looking at her as almost as an affiliation. So when she said that, I then realised that I'd made an assumption about her that she would understand. And it just brought home to me that we all have those unconscious biases within us.
Absolutely. And I think I'm very interested by what you talk about there in terms of the perception of poverty or disadvantage. I'm wondering whether, Catherine, you are aware of immediate assumptions that are made about you in
Absolutely, and I think I share a lot of Shan's perspective on this. We're very quick to make judgments when we look at a person based on your colour, your race, the way you speak, what sort of education you might have had, what skill set you might have, and what profession you might want to pursue. I definitely feel that I've had those experiences throughout my career where people have made judgments. Again, actually, Shan, a bit like you, I've had comments about, are you the PA? Maybe sort of slightly earlier on in my career, certainly had, turning up for meetings and having that assumption that I'm there to sort of take the notes or carry the bag. So we're all guilty of unconscious bias, absolutely. I don't think we would be true to ourselves if we said we weren't. But we have to be so careful not to put those prejudices across and make judgments. In a similar vein to Shan, I have scenarios where I come across most of the women I come across in a personal situation are mothers that have children at my children's school. And many of them make assumptions about what I do, and when I sort of really, for the ones that are interested, and explain what I do, some of them are very surprised. They can't even really comprehend that I'm able to juggle what I think will hopefully be and is a successful career. That is quite challenging and intense whilst juggling a young family and a marriage and a social life and all the other aspects that we try to fit into our lives. Mm. So yes, I have a certain experience of that as well.
Yeah, I think it's very easy. I mean, one of the things that I know that we've discussed as a group before is making assumptions about what people do. And Ed, I know that you've got some very interesting insights into that too. Would you like to share?
Well, I used to practice as a legal aid duty solicitor before I joined Kingsley Napoli about 5 years ago. And that meant that the client base was predominantly disadvantaged or underprivileged individuals. But that wasn't always the case. And it was, something that one tried to guard against, although couldn't always do that, to avoid making preconceptions about your clients. And about, interestingly, it harks back to what Shan was just saying, that an assumption that a kind of an economic position therefore equals a whole other set of outlooks, cultures, and so on. And so it's always something I've been aware of the risk of falling into, but I'm sure I haven't always avoided it. And now, find myself as a middle-aged, middle-class, white male, probably someone who's benefited, if anything, from unconscious biases that we have in society. Although, I'm married to a doctor who works part-time, and she finds, from her perspective, obviously, as a woman working part-time in a profession, that she certainly suffers from an element of second-class citizenship, because you're not able to devote what is considered to be the appropriate amount of time, effort, and concentration, even though, of course, it takes more than part of the effort to do a job like that for part of the time.
That's a very interesting insight, because one of the issues, it seems to me, is an assumption that if you have children, somehow your ability to totally commit to something is devalued. Whereas I may be wrong in saying this, but I'm assuming I'm right in saying that I'm sure that when your wife is at work, she is 150% there,
yeah,
just
absolutely.
As much as any of her colleagues. Catherine, would you like to?
Yes, and just picking up on a few things you said there, Ed, and thank you, Kate. I definitely felt that going back to work after maternity leave. Your priorities have clearly changed. It should be embraced that those priorities have changed. You have a family. Actually, one of my colleagues said to me many years ago, it's such a great thing to have a family and continue your career because it gives you a different perspective and actually allows you to relate to people in another level and relate to clients. And all of what we do is based on relationships with our clients and with shareholders and other colleagues. So it took me a long time, though, to really adapt to that and not be ashamed that I was a mother and that I would have to leave at a certain time. Because there is that assumption that suddenly your work is not as important as it should be. And that, for me, is one of the biggest frustrations as a society. I'm not sure we give women enough support to go back to work. And it's why we find ourselves in some industries. I think the legal profession is particularly good at this, but certainly in my industry, we are losing a skill set at the senior level because we haven't been able to encourage or support women sufficiently post that sort of typical 30s child rearing decade.
I think that's really interesting. One of the issues, it seems to me, is that it's very rare. I mean, nobody would dream of questioning the commitment of a man who's just because he's had children, and yet it seems to be acceptable to question the commitment of a woman who's had children. Perhaps a slightly controversial question, but I wonder whether there are positive steps that women need to take and reflections that women can make about how they deal with these issues. I don't know, Sian, whether you've...
Well, for me, I don't have children yet, but I'm always in awe of parents, both men and women, that come back to work after they've had children, because I can barely get myself out of bed and ready, let alone to then have children to look after and maintain, whether it's a full or a part-time job. So I find it strange in society when people automatically assume, especially with women, that their dedication to work drops after they've had a child, when they've had to maintain a really strict balance at home to be able to get back to work. And I think one of the things that we could do as women, as we're looking for balance to better, is actually encouraging men to take just as much parental leave, so that you are sharing the child-rearing responsibilities between us and not automatically assuming, and I think a lot of women do, that it's going to be them that then takes on the child-rearing responsibility. And I know that's something that's quite important to Ed.
Well, I was going to say, luckily we've got our male representative here. Ed, what's your view on that?
Well, very, very much so. You know, many women I speak to, mothers I speak to, will have been asked the question, you know, couched in terms of awe, but it's kind of slightly loaded, like, oh, how do you manage to juggle it? How do you manage to achieve it? It's a question that's almost never asked of men. And sometimes the criticism of that question asking seems to suggest that the question shouldn't be asked at all. But I think my view is very firmly that it should be asked, but it should be asked of everyone. Men should be asked. And if that was something that became more prevalent, the mindset that would follow, that men would not feel comfortable to say, oh, well, I don't have to juggle it because I don't do any of it, even if that was the reality. And so that might start to gradually change things.
So it's sort of a way of calling it out by actually expecting men to participate. I think that's a very interesting
and
idea.
And I think you make a great point, Ed, and I have two boys, and I really like the fact that it's a team effort. from myself and my husband. You know, it's a team effort on every level in terms of income that we generate as a family. That's very shared. The shared responsibility for the welfare of our children, the shared responsibility for just the logistics. You know, if there's a crisis, you know, we share the solution to that crisis together. And it really empowers my husband to be an active, involved father to my children. And they get the benefit of both parents being involved in an equal way. And you do find some criticism from people who, again, will say, I don't know how you do it. Surely the compromise must be the happiness or the welfare of your children for you both to work full time. And again, that's another unconscious bias or conscious bias that people have about what is right for each family. Not that that's right for everybody's family, but I think it's a real benefit that I see.
Well, and I doubt if anyone would argue with the idea that happy parents makes happy children. So I absolutely agree with that. And also I think as a mother of boys, Catherine and I have two boys as well, now grown up, but they benefit from seeing a really positive female role model and learn to expect that.
Yeah, I think it's very progressive in the way that society should certainly be going. I don't want my boys to be brought up in a society that the traditional values are the right values. They might be right for some families, but it depends on the circumstances, and I don't want them to have those prejudices. I want them to be open-minded.
I think that's a really key point of how we address unconscious biases in the future, because especially I think with boys actually, and then in a flip side with girls, if they are brought up in families where both parents are working in some capacity, if that's what's right for their family, or maybe dad is at home, if that's what's right for the family, that then instills in them a different view as to what maybe we had when we were growing up. And that's the way that we start kind of trickling down and tackling, and I know Ed said that kind of word, and using it and challenging can be difficult, but I think in some aspects we do need to hit it head on, to be perfectly honest, and not be soft about it.
And
I think that's a really important point that Catherine's made.
I also think that I know that there's research that shows that sons of mothers who work actually tend to do more domestic chores and things and grow up to be more involved fathers, so I think that's of itself very interesting. I think that We've very much focused on unconscious bias in relation to sort of at a national level. I'm quite, because we've got Catherine here, I'm interested to have a little bit of a wider look at sort of international issues, because as I understand it, the company that you work for is a Canadian company with Norwegian shareholders. And lots of interests in particular East Africa. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. And, Kate. Yes,
and
it's
what
a
sort of,
bit of a mix.
Yeah, absolutely. And what sort of sensibilities do you have to go into those different environments, and what issues does it throw up? You know, even by asking that question, am I showing my unconscious bias?
Well, it's a really interesting question, and there's there's a couple of different perspectives I think that I've been close to. I mean, one, just to touch on how do we make society more progressive from a male female parenting perspective. I think a very good example of that in my experience has been working with the Norwegian shareholders, being in Norway. Very progressive for women in business, very maternity and paternity is shared very equally between both parents. It's very progressive in that sense and forward looking, and you come across a lot of strong women in business that share parental role with the father, and that's been a very nice model that makes the UK look rather backward. But that, as Shan indicates, has been a legislative driven change in their society, and maybe this is what we need. It doesn't come unless it's sort of effectively tackled head on and forced through. So I think that's been an interesting part of my experience. the company that I work for was Canadian until recently, Canadian incorporated until recently when we re-domiciled the company. And working with, you know, with Canadians in my industry, oil and gas, typically a relatively old industry, lot of older, middle-aged white men, sorry Ed, but you know that there are a lot that I've come across a lot of prejudice against, you know, being relatively young female and working in that environment. So I would say that's the opposite. That's been my personal experience there, has been not progressive, and it's I've had to sort of work hard at that and drive a bit uphill. So that's been more of a challenge for me personally. But then on the flip side, I do a lot of work in Africa. Mm-hmm. So I travel to East Africa a lot because of the assets of the company that I work with. And they're very open, well-educated. You can make you can turn up to Tanzania and make judgments about the type of people you're going to come across and work with. And they are welcoming, educated, smart, progressive in diversity. There's, you know, there's been nothing but open spirit, and again, you know, you might not think that be the case.
Isn't that interesting? I mean, and again, if you're thinking about the points that Shan was making in relation to what goes into your perception of a person, actually, I suspect it's true also at a national level and even a continental level, because of course Africa is not a country, it's a continent, and there are lots of different countries within that continent, and I'm sure each of them is different, and it's all about the investment in the infrastructure and those sorts of things, that the education and the sense of empowerment of the people that permit development and growth. And
yes, I feel very strongly about that, Kate, because I think there's a tendency if you're working for Westerners working in emerging markets and lower developed countries, there's a tendency to just generalize and assume that all these emerging market countries have the same issues and the same challenges, and they don't. Every country in Africa is different. They all face different risks, and you have to really understand those cultural sensitivities and the country itself, rather than just sweep in and make casting generalizations about how the countries run, what the people are like, how they should be treated, etc. So I feel very strongly about that, and I think, you know, the irony as well is a lot of lower developed countries are actually much more open-minded and progressive in some respects, whether it be race, class, sex, age, than Western developed countries.
Mm. Well, that's
it's a surprise sometimes.
Yeah. I think that's very, very interesting. I suppose the next question that I want to ask, and maybe I'll start with Ed, is what we can actually do to make sure, I don't know, to check our own unconscious biases.
It's a good question. I mean, it's a challenge. There's no doubt about that. I mean, there's a need to be sort of thoughtful and introspective about one's own background, because that's often where unconscious biases come from. As a background, it can be family, it can be social, it can be, you know, class based, it can be regional, you know, all sorts of things. But just to try and develop an awareness of it. To do so in a way that, because I think the natural response when one examines one's own prejudices, because that's what we're effectively talking about, is to feel either ashamed about them or defensive about them. It's really trying to deal with these things in an environment where it's better to be open about it and candid about it, and to have it received by others in not necessarily a positive spirit, because the aim is to try and, if not eradicate, then certainly soften, reduce, whatever, these biases. But to kind of have an environment where they can be openly admitted and discussed without too much concern about the impression you're giving, the long-term effects it might have on the perception of you as an individual.
So just thinking about, I mean, the obvious debate around this issue is quotas, positive quotas.
Positive discrimination.
Positive discrimination, having quotas.
I'm conflicted about it, because I think you have, and Shan rightly said, there are certain areas where you just have to face these problems head on. And as Catherine was saying, that legislative change is what often drives this. There's a huge, I think, kind of block against the idea of quotas, and if they were to be introduced in this country, they haven't been yet, that block would probably be very vocal. But I sense that probably over time that opposition would diminish, and people would become accustomed to it, and then eventually think, well, what was the fuss about? And then you would have, you know, sometimes the only way to introduce these societal changes is by compulsion.
Mm.
Just relying on goodwill and best intentions will not do it.
Yeah, I mean, a very close example of that, Ed, to my personal situation is you're seeing more and more push from certain investors for increasing board diversity. So this is, you know, becoming a very hot topic. You see it from a legislative perspective in Norway. So there has to be at least one female director on a board of directors. We don't have that here in the city. Maybe we will at some point, because there is a push from certain large institutional investors now who want to see not just one, but 25%. And does 25% become 40%? And, you know, there will be a push. And whether it's formally legislative or whether it's just a bit of a noise that people then can't ignore, I think it's helpful. But I too, like you, Adam, feel conflicted, because it shouldn't be done unnaturally or inorganically to force it through. But at the same time, how else can we make the changes?
I think for me, I want it to be meaningful.
Yeah.
So I don't want quotas to be introduced and people and organisations treat it as a tick box exercise. That's why I'm conflicted about it, because I agree, places like Norway, where you see the legislation changing, the background is really important. But then I don't want it to be, whether it's the public sector or private bodies here, just saying, let's get that one woman on the board, let's get that one BAME individual on the board, etc., when they're not really investing in that person or the people around them to actually change the culture of the organisation. And I think that's what worries me about the potential positive quotas.
Yes.
But equally, I'm torn about it,
yes,
as well.
And there's that awful thing of, we've got one of those.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is just so reinforcing the other. So that's at a sort of... at a macro level. If we bring it right down to the micro level now and think about what we as individuals can do to, if you like, check our own unconscious biases and call it out when we see it. Does anyone have any views about that?
For me, one of the things that I think is quite important, and it really resonated with me when Catherine was speaking about the industry that she works in, is tackling language. How many little girls have been called bolshy or bossy instead of confident and tenacious like a man would be? And I think sometimes we just need to recognise when we're using those type of descriptors about people, and also call other people out when they're doing that. And it is quite simple, and it sounds simple, but it has to start somewhere. And those type of descriptors, especially for young girls and boys, can actually really resonate with them as they're growing up and change the way that they approach people. So I think those type of things are really important.
So number one is sort of mind your language. I think that's really helpful. Do either of you have views?
Well, I would just pick up on something Shan said. And so I've had comments said to me previously that I don't think are right, and I've never said anything. And actually, that doesn't help the discrimination. It's not highlighting that it's wrong. And typically, because it's been in a business scenario, you don't want the confrontation. And you can respond without confrontation or anger or actually necessarily being aggressive about it. But I think I personally could start by picking people up on it when they do say something and saying, actually, you wouldn't make that comment to a man, or you wouldn't make it to an older person, or you wouldn't necessarily make it to somebody else that you didn't think was my profile. And that's a good starting point, I think.
So mind your language. Call people out when
make
you hear
them. Make it conscious.
Yeah,
make the unconscious bias more conscious.
Absolutely.
Would be my
I agree entirely. And I come back to kind of where I started off, which was... there's a theme running through my comments, I recognise, which is that I have a preference, I suppose, for a non-confrontational methodology, which may be unrealistic, because if you have to deal with these issues, they are inherently uncomfortable, I suppose. Whether there is a way of training or educating people so that this process of calling people out, so either on language or just generally comments, can be done in a non-confrontational way. I mean, maybe that's a preliminary stage you need so that people don't feel defensive about it. If that can't be done, then, you know, maybe to hell with the consequences, you need to call people out, and if they're defensive, then that's their issue. But I do worry that, you know, the inherently negative and loaded and critical effect of calling people out means that it doesn't have the positive benefit, certainly initially. And it may take some time for it to be.
I agree with Ed, but I think one of the things that feeds into it, if you're going to do it in that way, and I agree non-confrontational is the best way, is having those positive role models inside of organisations. Because if you have them, then you don't need to be aggressive, as Catherine says, or have a driver that's really quite pushy and confrontational, because those positive role models will just instill a culture within those organisations that just permeates throughout everybody.
I think I, of course, would say this, wouldn't I, but I think that organisational values are so important because they help you call people out. And if you know the organisation will support you, then it's becoming much, much easier immediately to say, hang on a sec, that's not okay by me. I'm very, very aware that we have talked a lot and we're running out of time. Thank you very much. Does anyone have any final comments that they would like to wrap up with? Or all that remains for me to say then is many, many thanks to Catherine for coming in to share her thoughts with us, and for Shan and Ed for coming downstairs to share their thoughts with me. And
thank you for making me a part of this. Very much appreciate
it. Absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.